Hello, you're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker Magazine and director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. On this program, we invite poets to choose a poem from the New Yorker archive to read and discuss, along with a poem of their own that's been published in the magazine. My guest today is Nicole Seeley. She's the executive director at Cave Canem Foundation, and her poetry collection, Ordinary Beast, which was a finalist for the Penn Open Book Award, is also a 2018 Hurston Wright Legacy Award nominee. Welcome, Nicole. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the poem you selected from the archive is Indigo by Ellen Bass. Can you tell us what about this poem in particular caught your eye?
I was just immediately struck by this poem. It's not only is it beautiful, but it's so surprising throughout. And Ellen Bass's conversational style, I was really drawn to. Again, the surprise and how, while I was reading, just many of my expectations were just flipped upside down. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous poem. I can't really say enough about the beauty of it.
Let's hear it. Let's have a listen. Sure. Here's Nicole Seeley reading Indigo by Ellen Bass.
Indigo. As I'm walking on West Cliff Drive, a man runs toward me, pushing one of those jogging strollers with shock absorbers so the baby can keep sleeping, which this baby is. I can just get a glimpse of its almost translucent eyelids. The father is young, a jungle of indigo and carnelian tattooed from knuckle to jaw. Leafy vines and blossoms, saints and symbols. Thick wooden plugs pierce his lobes, and his sunglasses testify to the radiance haloed around him. I'm so jealous, as I often am. It's a kind of obsession. I want him to have been my child's father. I want to have married a man who wanted to be in a body, who wanted to live in it so much that he marked it up like a book, underlining, highlighting, writing in the margins. I was here. Not like my dead ex-husband, who was always fighting against the flesh, who sat for hours on his zafu chanting and then went out and broke his hand punching the car. I imagine when this galloping man gets home, he's going to want to have sex with his wife, who slept in late, and then he'll eat barbecued ribs and let the baby teethe on a bone while he drinks a cold, dark beer. I can't stop wishing my daughter had had a father like that. I can't stop wishing I'd had that life. Oh, I know, it's a miracle to have a life, any life at all. It took 8 years for my parents to conceive me. First, there was the war, and then just waiting, and my mother's bones so narrow, she had to be slit and I airlifted. That anyone is born, each precarious success from sperm and egg to zygote, embryo, infant, is a wonder. And here I am, alive. Almost 70 years and nothing has killed me. Not the car I totaled running a stop sign, or the spirochete that screwed into my blood. Not the tree that fell in the forest exactly where I was standing. My best friend shoving me backwards so I fell on my ass as it crashed. I'm alive, and I gave birth to a child. So she didn't get a father who'd sling her onto his shoulder, and so much else she didn't get. I've cried most of my life over that. And now there's everything that we can't talk about. We love, but cannot take too much of each other. Yet, she is the one who, when I asked her to kill me, if I no longer had my mind, we were on our way into Ross, shopping for dresses. That's something she likes, and they all look adorable on her. She's the only one who didn't hesitate or refuse or waver or flinch as we strode across the parking lot. She said, "Okay, but when's the cutoff? That's what I need to know."
That was Indigo by Ellen Bass, which appeared in the October 16th, 2017 issue of the magazine. So I actually didn't know this poem well before you picked it, Did you come on it yourself in the magazine or just looking over it recently? Or
in the magazine. I saw it in the magazine, and I was struck by the surprise of it. I initially thought that the speaker in the poem was being a bit judgy, looking at this dude with these tattoos. And then she totally flipped the script and said not only is she jealous, but she... That's an obsession of hers. She doubled down on her envy.
Right.
And that was amazing.
Yeah, and she sort of is desirous, you know, in this way.
Yeah.
Not just for him physically, but for this life of ease.
Exactly.
You know, the baby teething on a barbecue bone. I mean, that's a wonderful primal image. And I think that's something, there's something primal about the whole poem. I mean, she's really... invested in. I love the title, too. The title really takes you to a different place. I think you're expecting either something light and airy or something super political.
Of course.
And she manages to bridge the two and kind of the politics of life, of living, of being alive.
Yeah.
You know, I think we're going to get to some of that in your own work, but I wonder how it works here. You know, it seems like there's a lot of shifts for me.
There are a lot of shifts, and she does this often. I actually... didn't know Bass before this. And I was looking at her other work, and I saw this other poem titled Relax. And it's kind of the same thing that you were talking about, the just expectations and how the title might not match up with what's coming after. So Relax begins, bad things will happen. Your tomatoes will grow a fungus and your cat will get hit by a car. Right? And
right.
So she just...
I don't mean to laugh, but it's like it's like chilling to see someone be so honest or so absurd in their nihilism, let's call it.
And so I went down a rabbit hole with Ellen Bass, and I just started doing a bit of research preparing for this talk, and I came across this, the first New Yorker podcast was with Philip Levine, and he had actually chosen a poem by Bass.
Mm.
It was called What Did I Love? And again, it began, what did I love about killing the chickens?
Right.
Right. And so she just flips the whole script on the reader.
Well, it's very gimlet-eyed, I feel. And then I think there's that moment when she says, almost 70 years and nothing has killed me.
Nothing has killed me.
That's another shift to me where she's talking about sort of disappointment and various things. And then she's talking about, you know, the moment where she gets pushed on her ass to survive this tree crashing. And there's a kind of switch from looking outward to looking inward and in a way back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that real shift really is interesting to me in the rest of the poem. The car I totaled running a stop sign. I'm alive and I gave birth to a child, which she's sort of held back a little bit.
Yeah. So not only is she alive, she was able to give birth to life, right?
She also says, so she didn't get a father who'd sling her onto his shoulder. There's a level of regret even in that later part. What do you make of that?
I feel like even in regret, there's some bit of being fortunate. She's definitely saying thank you to the gods for this child who will, if she loses her mind, will kill her. Right? And
right.
And isn't that love? Like, that's extreme love. Mm. Right? So I think it's both regret and, you know, saying thank you.
Yeah. Well, there's a level of mercy that she's thinking about at the end of the poem. And something throughout, she's sort of being merciful in the big kind of not just thankful, but thinking of the mercy that spared her when it hasn't spared others or hasn't spared anyone from disappointment. And I think that kind of human connection is fascinating. I don't know when it starts because there's so much about the skin, about the runner's skin, the father, but then also the child with the almost translucent eyelids, which I think is really a powerful image and true. But I'd never seen it in a poem, which is something that I think poems do, is observe the world and make it new again.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there's something haunting in that. You probably have passed someone with tattoos or running or any of the things that she's observing, but suddenly you realize that's a miracle. You know, there's something about that.
And it's everything is just very matter of fact. Even the mention of going into Ross and trying on dresses, like that's a very human, very contemporary moment, right? That most people, at least I, connected with because I love me some Ross.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's just throughout, it's just so the whole thing is just very human. And again, reading about her and her work, she said in an interview, a good poem changes me as I'm writing it, and a very good poem manages to change the reader as well. So I was definitely changed while reading it, but I could also, while reading it, see the surprise that she was experiencing while writing it.
Exactly. I think that there's a kind of transparency and generosity in that, in showing your hand, because it's not coy in a way, which isn't to say it isn't structured and very conscious and thoughtful. It has a kind of plain-spokenness. Maybe that's another way to put what you said. But it's also interested in mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the sweet spot for me and poets like Lucille Clifton or I think Brooks in her own way in a different kind of language are trying to express, you know, much of that mix of the plain-spokenness.
Definitely.
And the kind of magical, we don't quite always know.
Yeah. And Phil Levine spoke to that in the podcast as well. He likened her to poets like William Carlos Williams and Walt Whitman and Elizabeth Bishop and others.
These are, you know, poets you might want to be compared to.
Exactly.
One might like that. One, I think also there's something you know, about her writing about women's lives in this poem that I think is really striking to me, that is really powerful.
Yeah. You can definitely see the influence of her teachers, Anne Sexton, and her mentor, Dorian Locks, talking about women's issues. And I also, in my research, found that she does workshops for children who have been abused sexually. And so, these issues are very close to her heart, yet she doesn't play her hand close to her chest, which is like, how can one do that? Because these issues are so intimate and that she lays it all on the table is very commendable.
Well, and I think it's artful. What I like about the end of the poem, too, is this way that when's the cutoff? That's what I need to know. And for I go back and forth between thinking that's the daughter saying, that's what I need to know. And then sort of the inner monologue of the speaker saying, that's what I need to know. I need to know when am I here and when am I not here, even though I'm still here. How do you read the ending?
You know, I didn't know how to read it because it's not italicized, it's not in quotes. So it can go either way. So that's a question I'll have to pose to Ellen Bass.
Well, and to the reader, as you said, the reader now has inherited this change of the poem. And I think, again, that's a moment of plain spokenness, but the mystery that all the poets we've mentioned, I think, capture well. Let's look at another poem by someone named Nicole Seeley.
Sure.
Now, in the August 8th, 2016 issue, The New Yorker published your poem, A Violence, which you're about to read for us. Is there anything briefly you'd like to say about it beforehand? Anything listeners should know going in?
Nothing really going in. Where I was, my headspace was such that I had just gotten married, and immediately after the wedding, folks were asking, so where are the babies? Where are the babies?
So this is the headspace. Folks sometimes do. Okay, yeah.
A Violence. You hear the high-pitched yowls of strays fighting for scraps tossed from a kitchen window. They sound like children you might have had you wanted children. Had you a maternal bone, you would wrench it from your belly and fling it from your fire escape, as if it were the stubborn shard now lodged in your wrist. No, you would hide it. Yes, you would hide it inside a barren nesting doll you've had since you were a child. Its smile reminds you of your father, who does not smile, nor does he believe you are his. You look just like your mother, he says, who looks just like a fire of suspicious origin. A body, I've read, can sustain its own sick burning, its own hell for hours. It's the mind. It's the mind that cannot.
That was A Violence by Nicole Seeley.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So that poem strikes me again as sharing some of the qualities of the Bass poem. It has a frankness to it. It's plain spoken in places. No, you would hide it. Yes, you would hide it. There's a kind of self-awareness, but also a kind of conjuring as the poem is going along. To me, it seems like it starts to open up more, even as it's sort of closing in on its subject, which is haunting. You know, nor does he believe you are his. You look just like your mother, he says, who looks just like a fire of suspicious origin. And you get that wonderful other voice in there. Tell us about, you know, sort of the many violences in the poem. I mean, it's called A Violence, but I thought of there were many violences.
Yeah. The violence that the speaker has done to herself, the violence that the father of the speaker has done to his daughter, the violence of the world and its expectations of women, the mind, you know, the violence the mind can play, can do, can the mind can harm as much as anything, as much as fire. So again, I'm just speaking to the moment, several moments that I was asked right after getting married, when are the children coming? And it's a hard question to answer, right? Because people assume that the person they're asking can actually have children. And if they can, that they want to. And so, yeah, and it's hard to not smile and say, soon come, or, you know, we don't know. But you do that. We do that.
So is this poem an inner monologue by the speaker, or is it like, because there's this great you here.
Yeah.
You know, there's the kind of external, you know, I love the second person as an I or as, you know, they, whoever the figure is.
I think I might have unconsciously thought I was too close to this poem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to disconnect as much as I do in real time when I'm asked those questions about children.
Sure.
Yeah. And this poem was very, it was cool to write in that it was very surprising. I'd had the first few lines and it wasn't until No, You Would Hide It, the Baron nesting doll came in the picture, and that was just really surprising for me. You know, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. So I was just very excited when that line came to me, and then the rest followed.
There's a kind of humor, too. Had you a maternal bone, you would wrench it from your belly and fling it from your fire escape.
Yeah.
And there's the fire again, right?
Yeah.
Were you conscious of the humor or, you know, and even what the father says, but at the same time, there's a kind of, you know, there's a dark humor, as
yeah.
it were.
I don't think I was conscious of it, but I do think that in life we get the light and the dark simultaneously. And that's back to Ellen's poem, The Ross, you know, going to Ross and trying on dresses. Even in these moments of great darkness, there's lightness, there's levity. And I think that the two can exist at once. And
yeah.
Because I'm not a person who is always in the dark, some light had to come in.
Sure. I think for me sometimes when writing, those lighter things will come in and the temptation is to take them out and to make the poem one tone. And, you know, of course the best poems like the blues or something have all those different tones. And I admire that in your work. You have that great poem, Object Permanence, which I think has a similar thing. It's not so much humor, but a loveliness where it's kind of a marriage poem, an epithalamian in some way. And it ends with the lines, you say them better than I can. So,
oh, how we entertain the angels with our brief animation, "Oh, how I'll miss you when we're dead."
That's a line right there. I mean, because that's a true statement, but people don't say it in poems. They say, you know, "Oh, the stars foreverness," you know, et cetera. I love that.
That's a great compliment. Thank you.
I wonder, too, maybe you can speak, you know, I want to talk a little bit briefly just about your book, Ordinary Beast. And tell me how these poems we're talking about, the kind of poles that I'm mentioning, how they fit into the book as a whole.
They fit in because they're part of me. I created them.
Sure.
So they have, the through line is me, is my voice. But they're all very different one from the other. Even the poems that are part of series, like the legendary poems, you know, although they're in the series, they're each different one from the other because they're essentially in the voice, each is in the voice of a person from Paris is Burning. Paris is Burning is a problematic documentary about drag balls in 1980s Harlem. And it features many quote-unquote drag queens, female impersonators, and it just really looks at their art, I think, in a very artful way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, there's a lot to say about that.
And of course.
Do you think, you know, about questions of gender in the book and you know, race? And
I do. I think about everything. I think about gender, and I think about gender roles. A violence speaks to that specifically. I talk about race. I talk about love. I talk about, you know, I have many obsessions. And
tell us two we might not know.
Oh, my goodness. Obsessions. That's in the book or just personal obsessions?
Well, let's see. Let's decide. Well, you know, like, you can't see everyone, but she's wearing the most beautiful yellow shoes.
Oh,
like,
you're
very hip. So,
so fashion is one of my many obsessions.
Ross.
Ross, yes. I love comedy. I love humor.
Mm-hmm.
I love art.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I interned at the Studio Museum back in the day when I was like 20-something.
The Studio Museum in Harlem.
Our
neighbor and friend uptown.
Exactly.
So, you bring that to the page. And the cover of the book, tell us what that image is. It's a striking image.
This is an image by the artist Deborah Dancy. And so I wanted to not only have only blurbs by black women on the book, but I also wanted art by a black woman. And, of course, Rachel Eliza Griffiths took my photo for the book. So I wanted this to be a whole black women thing.
This is before Lemonade, or this is, that's wonderful.
And Danez is so fun. Danez Smith actually called my blurbers the In Vogue of blurbers, which is hilarious.
It's a pretty high compliment.
It is. For
if
both,
you know 90s R&B the way that I know you might. So
for both groups of women.
You must. And y'all must out
but
there.
But this image is beautiful in that there's so much confrontation happening, although one of the figures, the black figure's back is turned to the reader. She's looking directly into the white figurines.
And these are ceramic figures?
Ceramic figures.
Yeah, that she really makes and then photographs, or they're found?
They're found. She places them and photographs them.
Yeah, yeah. There's that quality of kind of like what would happen if all the ceramics in the antique store, you know, got down to business after hours or something.
And came alive, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wonderful. That's powerful.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could end with telling us just a little bit about Kaveh Khanum, which you direct, and tell us, you know, its import is so big, certainly my opinion and the opinion of others. You, as an organization, tell us what you all have done, how long you've been around, and sort of we all should know that you've shaped the literary landscape, but tell us about
it
real
quick. Of
course.
Kaveh Khanum is a literary nonprofit. It was started by Toy Diracot and Cornelius Eady in 1996 to remedy the underrepresentation of black poets in the field. And so we have a flagship program. It's the week-long writing retreat that takes place in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, at the University of Pittsburgh at Greensburg, wherein 35, 36 black poets come through, and they write a poem a day, and they get to study with both emerging, their cohort, and established, their teachers, established writers in the field. You have taught there.
I have.
We were so excited to have you. Claudia Rankine.
Sure.
Yeah, Yusuf Komunyakaa.
Everyone, pretty much.
Yes. Yeah. And Robin Coase Lewis was there as a guest poet
this past
summer. Yeah, that was fun. We also have regional workshops, two of which will be happening in fall for more emerging poets.
Sure.
Of color. And we have book prizes, several of them.
You do? Really?
Yes.
The ones that have gone on
to win? Exactly.
I mean, I think that's what's fascinating is in the prize, I don't know what the record is of people who've gone on to win Pulitzers. I know of two.
Yeah.
Are there more than that? I mean, certainly there's many more poets who got their start through the Kaveh Kahnen Prize, who now are essential to our thinking of American
So Natasha Trethewey and Tracy K. Smith, both of whom were Kaveh Kahnen Poetry Prize winners, went on to win the Pulitzer.
And be Poet Laureate.
And, exactly. And, you know, other folks, Major Jackson, Ricky Laurentiis,
we could go down the
Natalie
list.
Graham, Danica Kelly. You know, there's a whole tradition.
She was up for the National Book Award.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
yes.
I think that it's hard to overstate how important Kaveh Kahnen has been for broadening the conversation and bringing people to the table who were already at the table in a way, but you know, letting them you know, recognize in that way that Langston Hughes talks about. You know, I will sit at the table, and no one, how's he put it, no one will, you know, say something to me then. I'm sorry, Langston, I'm getting you a little bit wrong. But, you know, that sense of the welcome table, I think, is really important. And making sure we understand the many influences, too, that come in there the door and also that, you know, are able to look around and see what's new and what's exciting in poetry.
And this was just an idea. Like, it was just an idea, and it became a thing. It's like a revolution. Thank you, Toy. Thank you, Cornelius.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you so much for being here and talking with us, Nicole.
It's my pleasure.
A Violence by Nicole Seely, as well as Ellen Bass's poem Indigo, can be found on NewYorker.com. Ellen Bass's most recent poetry collection is Like a Beggar. Nicole Seely's latest book is Ordinary Beast. Thanks again.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Rope-A-Dope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Eisenman.